sin, there's real damage occurring to the body. It's beginning to decompose. Now, that could easily be reversed by supernatural power in recreating those things that had been destroyed in the decomposition. That could be done. Or, instead of allowing decomposition and then recreating, there could be simply a preservation from decomposition. As in the case, now here's the model, of Christ's body in the grave, where he says, you will not allow your Holy One to suffer decay. It could be off that model that we're working. Ray.
Well, could someone say that Jesus was not dead then in the third sense, that he was merely in a coma? I mean, you could say that.
Yes, you could say that if he were only dead in the first sense, clinical death, then we have cases where people who were pronounced clinically dead came back to consciousness again and lived again, talked about it. As far as death in the second sense, however, that's an interesting question. See, that's what legal death is now in Pennsylvania. No brainwave activity. Now, of course, most of those people, I mean, well, not most of them, you have to keep those people alive, okay? Because obviously things aren't working. You have to keep people alive. Blood, air, and oxygen, you have to keep them alive. Fluids, that sort of thing. But in the third sense, irreversible loss of vital functions. Now, maybe it's necessary to have in this discussion some conception of death between the second and the third. That is, to meet the scriptural statement about you will not allow your Holy One to see corruption. Maybe there's something that has to be posited in between the second and the third sense of death. Leroy.
Now, when we talk, and these three definitions we've given, trying to figure out how we would understand death,
right. Okay. Without getting into the decomposition.
Yeah. Okay. Would be right after life experience. So I would just say that it's not included.
No, that's correct. That's correct. That's correct. So it might be a lot simpler than just to go with that basic definition in terms of dissolution of the union. Yeah. Good. That would help a great deal. Stephen.
Well, and it also goes without saying we're talking about cases of more miraculous resurrection.
True, true.
It could involve a reunification, obviously, of that dissolution.
Oh, no question there. No question there. If we define death as the dissolution, then the reuniting has to occur for life to once again occur. But that gets us at least away from the idea of decomposition and decay as a necessary component of the definition of death in each of the cases where people were brought back to life. But then there would be some preservation then of the body, perhaps of from decaying. There certainly was in Christ's case. You don't have to posit that with all the other cases. You can allow decomposition and then recreation. You can do that. But at least with Christ's case, you have a pattern there that you could use for other cases as well. In the case of people who are going to be miraculously raised from the dead. Then the miracle would be not so much the idea of reconstituting the body in terms of cells that have been destroyed and brain cells and so on, but in terms of the bringing together, the reuniting of the soul, spirit, and the body. Could be understood in that way. Well, question?
That passage in, I can't remember where it was in your notes, some that says you will not allow your Holy One to undergo corruption.
Acts 2.
There was a question I had about that parallelism.
Yes. I was back on page 196, second half of the page, and then the top of 197. That's the one I had Brian read from the NIV.
Okay, where David says of him, 196 at the bottom, I was beholding the Lord in my presence, he's at my right hand. So presence and at my right hand seem to be synonymous. Then it says, I was glad and my tongue exulted, and my flesh also will abide in hope. There seems to be a similarity there. Then you will not abandon my soul to Hades, nor allow your Holy One to undergo decay. So I'm thinking that a person, generally speaking, that if you speak of decaying, that person's in a grave, in a physical grave. I lost my point.
Yeah, it may come back. I do that frequently. My doctor says it's a function of aging. I wouldn't think it was so in your case.
I can't remember exactly what it was, but it had to do with I felt that parallelism wasn't being taken into account, that it's a synonymous parallel, or at least complementary, that Hades and decay are closely linked.
It may not be synonymous, and I suggest that there are two things going on here. One with regard to the non-material part, and one with regard to the material part, both constituting the one person. So you have a holistic concept, but still a distinction. You can, of course, understand this as being a synonymous parallel. You can do that.
What you're saying is that you will not leave me in a state of death.
Yeah, you could take it that way.
Resurrection.
Yes, you could take it that way. And some take a few instances of Hades in the New Testament in that very fashion, as the grave or physical death, the state of physical death. Other comments, questions? Susan.
In your analysis of Luke 15, verse 31,
yes. Yes.
For a time,
middle of 199.
Right. For a time, the rich man might think in bodily terms.
Yes.
But eventually, he was not. Does that imply that he becomes conditioned to this?
I would think so.
Well, in the case of when we go into and discuss the final state, I mean, are they going to get used to that torment, or is that something that will never be?
Well, let's hold that for the moment until we look at the final states and then talk about it. Because there's a lot of material that's been published lately, in the last year and a half, 2 years, that raised some serious questions about the whole business. But is it too late to take a break? All right, let's take a break. Let's hold it to 10 minutes, please. There are two appendices here on pages 200 and 201 into 203. One, Sheol or Hades during the Old Testament period, and two, Christ's alleged descent into Hades. I have a number of long charts and diagrams showing that during the Old Testament period, Sheol, Hades was comprised of two compartments. And one was a paradise of bliss, the other was a hell of misery. And that Sheol Hades was a rather dark and dismal place in the depths of the earth, in which disembodied spirits were imprisoned. Then, of course, Christ came, he emptied out, and that's where you see the connection between this and Christ's alleged descent into Hades. He emptied out Sheol Hades, he took the captives with him to Paradesos, and then they continued with him with that Old Testament section now emptied out. The Old Testament holding, well, no, that's that's a caricature. I was going to say a holding tank. But that Old Testament, the place was emptied out, and people were now in heaven during that time, or at least in Paradesos, paradise. I've suggested in this first appendix that the way that view of Hades arose is directly from Greek mythology, pagan Greek mythology. Hades was considered as a receptacle of departed spirits. It had two compartments, one an Elysium of bliss for the good, the other a Tartarus of sorrow and punishment for the wicked, and that it lay underground in the mid-regions of the earth. Now, of course, that's a very neat and simple solution, even for many evangelicals, because if you draw earth and if you draw Hades as sort of in the center of the earth, then people on earth go to one of two places. Either they go down to Hades or they go up to heaven. Now, of course, up is all different directions, which is a little problematic. But down is always down to the center of the earth, which is a very simple and neat solution. That comes right out of pagan Greek mythology. And curiously enough, Thayer takes that directly over. Now, you remember the footnote or the note on Thayer in the use of lexicons in regard to bapto and baptizo. In Thayer, the first meaning is usually the meaning in classical Greek. Second meaning, if there is usage in Septuagint Greek, it's there. Third meaning is used in New Testament. Fourth meaning, perhaps in papyri, etc. Well, here you'd say, well, okay, first one is Hades, Pluto, god of the lower regions. So in Homer, okay, classical Greek. Two, an appellative, Orcus, another world, the realm of the dead. In the Septuagint, the Hebrew Sheol is almost always rendered by this word. I'm toward the bottom of page 200. It denotes, therefore, in biblical Greek, Orcus, the infernal regions, a dark and dismal place in the very depths of the earth, the common receptacle of disembodied spirits. In biblical Greek, Thayer says, that's what it means. Now, to me, that's incredible. That is astounding. Because it meant this in classical Greek mythology, and because Hades is the same word that was used by the classical Greeks, therefore, Hades in the New Testament means what it meant in pagan Greek mythology. Well, I was brought up on that. I didn't question it. It's fortunate that we can study the usage of Hades in the New Testament without bringing with us all that baggage. And when we do that, we discover that Hades does not have that conception at all. We looked at all of the uses of Hades. You read them. I just mentioned them briefly. Hades is, I suggest, the place of disembodied wicked spirits in the intermediate state. Now, some expositors believe that Hades, in at least one and maybe two of the uses, could refer to the state of death, physical death. But in the other uses, contextually, it quite clearly means the place of the disembodied wicked during the intermediate state. And it doesn't have two compartments. If you want to say, at death, people go to one of two places, or two realms or two dimensions or something like that. That's perfectly proper. But to just take over that conception and talk about compartments and then build a whole theology of death on that whole situation and a change from the Old Testament to the New built on that Greek conception, that's really bad theology. Now the second one seems to, the Appendix 2, seems to lend some weight to that whole procedure. So we really have to look at it. Of course someone will say, what do you mean? It's in the Apostles' Creed. Well, that's pretty weighty stuff. If it's in the Apostles' Creed, he descended into hell, then you've got to do something with it because something of such antiquity would not be there unless it had been tested and tried and tested. And to just challenge that seems to be the height of arrogance. I suggest here that there are certain passages connected with this idea of Christ's alleged descent into Hades. Matthew 27, that doesn't really hold much weight, especially since this is not a general resurrection of Old Testament saints, only a local phenomenon in the vicinity of Jerusalem. In fact, it doesn't even say all the saints were raised in around Jerusalem, but many of them. And there's no connection between that and the alleged descent into Hades. And then there are other problems as well. Ephesians 4, 8 through 10. This is frequently quoted. When he ascended on high, he led captivity a host of captives, and he gave gifts to men. Now this expression, he ascended, what does it mean except that he also had descended into the lower parts of the earth? There you have it, the lower parts of the earth. And I suggest here the two clauses that are particularly stressed, he led captivity captive, and he also descended first in the lower parts of the earth. First clause, quotation from Psalm 68:18, which is really not necessary to understand as taking people out of the compartment of the paradisos compartment of Hades during the Old Testament period, led captivity captive. That's really an overkill. The second clause, what does it mean? He also had descended into the lower parts of the earth. Isaiah 61:1. Lower, of course, is the key word. And, of course, if you understand that in the incarnation, the earth is certainly lower, in a sense, speaking of transcendence and immanence, than heaven. And Christ came to the lower with respect to heaven, came from heaven to earth. We even talk of it that way. And thus, he came to the lower part, and then he ascended also. He descended, and he ascended. 1 Peter 3, 18 through 20. This one is a key. Having been put to death in the spirit, but made alive in the flesh, but made alive in the spirit, in which he went and made proclamation to the spirits now in prison, who once were disobedient, when the patience of God kept waiting in the days of Noah during the construction of the ark, in which a few, that is, eight persons, were brought safely through the water. And the suggestions made about this passage and how it is to be interpreted. I suggest the best interpretation that Christ did not go to Hades at all for any of these purposes, but rather that he was not abandoned to Hades. He was not abandoned to Hades. But then the problem is, how did he preach through Noah? Well, if Noah were a preacher of righteousness during his day, and if Christ preached by the Spirit through Noah, that is, the second person of the Trinity, preached through Noah to the unsaved people who were disobedient to that gospel in the time immediately preceding the flood, those very people who are now in prison, the prison of Hades, then that makes perfect sense of 1 Peter 3, 18 through 20. Of course, 1 Peter 4 is added. 1 Peter 4, which speaks of the gospel preached in times past to those who have since died, in order that their flesh might be judged and condemned, and that their spirit might be made alive. Of course, the historical question, that looms large. Where does it appear historically? Well, Eusebius of Caesarea mentions it. Clement of Alexandria. Origen. Cyril of Jerusalem, Athanasius, Ambrose, Jerome. Augustine, of course, rejected the view, called it a heresy. So you do have some adverse witness from that period. During the Middle Ages, it dominated the scholastic writers, was frequently used to support the dogma of purgatory. The Reformation leaders rejected the view for three reasons, regarded as traditional, not a scripture belief, appeared to give some support to the Roman Catholic view of purgatory. It appeared late in the creeds of the church. How late? Well, it didn't appear in the Apostles' Creed in Recension of 150 or of 350. It appeared in the official version of the Apostles' Creed of A.D. 700. So it's kind of interesting. Various groups have rejected it, various groups have accepted it, and on various grounds. But we still retain that clause in the Apostles' Creed. He descended into hell. And I noticed in one church it had the footnote down at the bottom that he continued for a time under the power of death, and that's what it meant. He descended into Hades. He descended into hell. Of course, Hades is bad if it's the place of wicked departed spirits during the intermediate state. He descended into Hades. But if it simply means he remained in the power of death for a period of time, that's building on the one or two references in which Hades is used where it means physical death, or where it's thought to mean physical death. I suggest that it would probably be better to drop this descent into Hades concept as an interpretation of he descended into hell from our evangelical doctrine. Comments? Questions? Ray.
Where you quoted, I think it's Ephesians.
Yes.
Where it says, you who, where is it?
Page 201, and then a little bit in the 202.
When he ascended on high, he led a host of captives, led a host of captives and gave gifts to men. This expression, he ascended, does not mean... What does it mean, except that he also had descended into the lower parts of the earth? Now, it goes on to say someplace, it's either in Romans or Ephesians, that says to say that he didn't descend is to bring Christ up from the dead, and to say who ascended into heaven is to imply that Christ did not descend from heaven. In other words, it seems to be saying that the grave is contrasted to heaven somehow. In other words, Christ comes from heaven, he dies. So the lower parts of the earth is referring to the grave,
mm-hmm.
not just heaven as being in a lower position, or earth being in a lower position from heaven.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, it's not a contrast between the heavenly places and the earthly realm.
Mm-hmm.
But it's talking about death.
State of death.
Yeah.
Yes, the reference is in Romans 10, 6 and 7 particularly. Do not say in your heart, who will ascend into heaven? That is to bring Christ down. Why? Because he has already become incarnate. Or who will descend into the abyss? That is to bring Christ up from the dead. Why? Because he's been raised from the dead. Yes, it could be understood in that sense. And that's why I guess some of these, some of the notes have been put on the Apostles' Creed, that idea of death. He continued under the power of death for a time.
And if we link, I'm thinking if we link Jude, it says there,
the evil ones, the evil angels are held in Hades, I guess, or in Tartarus, it says, until the day of judgment. I'm not so sure we can dismiss this conception of hell being in the lower parts of the earth, or this separated, at least conceptually, because the only place, as far as I know, that Tartarus is used is in the books of Enoch, where it talks about, and it actually goes into elaboration, that, you know, they went down and they saw these people chain the walls and the torment, the fire, and all this business. And there's an allusion in Jude to Enoch.
Mm-hmm.
As a matter of fact, he gets that idea from Enoch. And in the book of Enoch, where he gets the idea, that's where Tartarus is.
Mm-hmm.
And so we could say, well, he's using Tartarus, but he's not using it the same way these other people are. But then he's getting his content from the book that spoke of Tartarus in those terms.
Mm-hmm. Again, it's a very real hermeneutical question in terms of the meaning content that is given to Greek words used in the New Testament. And I know there's quite a bit of controversy about that. Some expositors, quite frankly, feel that if a Greek word is used, then you carry the baggage of meaning of that Greek word into the New Testament, however it's used in its original contexts. Others have suggested the idea that in some cases, at least, distinct meanings are given which may build off of or even depart from, be distinct from, the meanings used in the context in which you find them. And I know that's quite a controversy. Oh, no, Ray, again. Yes, you were pointing. This is getting to be a tradition. Thank you, Ray.
I was thinking more of a concept than just the word that's being spoken of in that passage.
Yes.
He talks not only about the word of Tartarus, but he talks about angels being bound. Well, I'm thinking we've got the extreme that says, you've got the liberals to say, well, they're just,
right,
Jesus and his disciples are just thinking of concepts that the people had, which weren't necessarily true, but it doesn't matter. Jesus is just teaching a spiritual truth. So you've got that extreme who just wants to dismiss Jesus' speeches or sermons as being just accommodation to the people. But yet at the same time, I think that many people go the other extreme. And I think that Jude is an example where we have to point out that, and he talks, for example, about the assumption of Moses, alludes to it, a book that is supposed to have existed. The angel Michael and the devil arguing, well, that's not found in the Old Testament anywhere.
No.
But it is found in extra biblical sources.
Yes.
And so there has to be a sense in which these things inform the theology and the teaching, or the thinking, I should say, of the people to which the Bible writers were writing. And a lot of times they assume these things, like the mediation of angels. Paul doesn't argue about it. There were no angels mediating there. He just assumes it and speaks as if it were actually the fact.
Yes.
Now, I don't want to do like the liberals do and suggest that it's just all convention. Yet at the same time, these things exist, and I have yet to hear a satisfactory response to that. As a matter of fact, I hear very little about Jude altogether, let alone how Carter is.
Well, we'll have to keep our eye open to see if we run across something that's very helpful on Judah. I'm sure there must have been good stuff written about it, the problems there.
Anyway, can I give you a paper? I was at a restaurant yesterday, and so I'll build that.
No, I don't
want to read it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
May I keep this?
Yeah.
Yes. Thank you. If you talk to him, tell him you're sorry he's not feeling well. Okay? I wasn't even
fact, I was going to talk to the gentleman about this.
Yes, sir.